Hey guys, this is Kevin Estello with Fieldcraft Survival. Just a quick heads up before we get to this podcast. Just want to kind of key you into some training that's coming up. We're going to be at Winkler Knives. This is a brand new location for us. Winkler Knives, I've been good friends with them for years through my SIOC connection as a SIOC instructor. Dan Winkler obviously makes the SIOC R&D Tomahawk that has been featured prominently on Jack Carr merchandise and all over the Terminalist series that's been on Amazon Prime. We're going to Winkler Knives this November. Jerry Young is going to be teaching modern survival skills November 18th. I will be teaching that day here in Aberdeen, but then I'm driving out that night and I will be teaching land navigation at Winkler Knives Actual in Boone, North Carolina on November 19th, which I'm pretty damn excited. Daniel has been a good friend over the years. I use a number of his knives and I have a collaboration knife with him that's coming out, which I am so excited to share with you guys. Very limited supplies, but it's going to be really cool to be back in Boone, visiting with a good friend. You never know who, by the way, will be in that class. So just keep that in mind. November 18th, Modern Survival Skills. November 19th, Land Navigation coming to Boone, North Carolina. Also, another heads up, we're adding more courses to Utah, Modern Survival courses to Utah. So Jared, who is on Instagram as @ArmyMace, ArmyMace. Jared is a longtime Fieldcraft instructor, solid primitive skills guy, Army veteran. The dude is knowledgeable. He is going to be training out in Utah. Look for him on December 2nd, and he's going to bring it to that course. Guys, this podcast is totally made possible by two of our good sponsors, good friends, Sig Sauer and Hoist Drinks. So let's start off with Hoist. Hoist has been supplying folks here at the Fieldcraft Survival North Carolina Firebase for quite some time. They send us cases of energy drinks, or I should say hydration drinks, as well as some of the other formulas that were specially developed for the military. Hoist is being used by a lot of different people. It's available all over now. You can find it in various supermarkets. I've seen it all over the place, and it tastes really, really good. You know, there are some pretty popular flavors. I'm not going to tell you which one my favorite is, but I'll let you discover yours. Please check them out. That's hoist.com. And it's a great electrolyte replacement drink. So if you're training out in Utah where it gets super hot, if you're training here in North Carolina where it gets super hot, if you are doing physical activity, like sweating a whole bunch, you need to rehydrate. And I recommend that you try out Hoist. And then obviously, anytime that you're using any type of rehydration drink, always mix it with additional water and just get copious amounts of fluids in your body. So with that being said, please check out our good friends at Hoist. The other company I want to recognize is Sig Sauer. I've had the privilege of training at the Sig Sauer Academy so many times. I'm actually currently looking at some of the courses in Florida at the Volusia County Gun Club. There are a lot of opportunities for professional development down there. I'm personally interested in taking the Bullets and Bandages course, but then I'm also interested in doing their Dynamic Performance Pistol. I've done Dynamic Performance Rifle, and it was a gut check how difficult some of the standards are, but it's really important that you always have good standards when you're training. So Sig Sauer, they are top-notch when it comes to instruction. I have a lot of good friends that are up at Sig Sauer, a lot of great memories of that academy and learning everything from pistol, carbine, defensive shotgun, and precision rifle up there. So whenever I have the opportunity to just jump into a Fieldcraft class as one of the assistant instructors, I never fancy myself a gun instructor. I always say, hey, I'm just a civilian who is a training junkie, and I've been training for over two decades. And I usually say that the three places that I've learned, where I've learned firearms, SIOC Tactical, Gunsight Academy, and of course, Sig Sauer. In Sig, they have had so much of my time, so much of my money, and I'm really, really proud to call that place my my alma mater for so many different firearms training. And guys, let's put it this way. You can go to the range and you can practice, or you can go to an academy and get trained. Please get training. Just turning a whole bunch of money into noise is not the same as getting coached by the best in the business. So please check out Sig Sauer. They make fantastic firearms. They've got great training, amazing suppressors. I think it's like a one-stop shop for all of you guys out there that are training junkies just like me. All right. So with that being said, we're going to get to this podcast. But again, thank you so much to Sig. please visit them at www.sigsauer.com. And thank you so much, Hoist, for hydrating us. That is hoist.com, H-O-I-S-T.com. Here we go. Let's get to this podcast.
How's it, everyone? This is Nate. I get to welcome you to the podcast and tell you about our sponsor for today, which is Oakley Standard Issue. Oakley Standard Issue is a division of Oakley specifically for serving those that serve government, military, law enforcement, firefighters, and EMS, the whole lot. Qualified members are going to get exclusive access to new products, service-related discounts, that's the big one, but a whole lot more. Products they're probably already known for is the eyewear. Their eyewear is ballistic rated and industrial certified, perfect for on the job. Footwear that meets uniform regulations while on duty, which is kind of a big deal. Some of my favorite boots I've ever had are the Oakley boots that I picked up when I was in Fort Bliss doing a ton of ruck marches there. Other accessories like gloves and backpacks. Some of my favorite gloves I've ever had have also been Oakley gloves. Newly released off-duty styles and collections are definitely stuff that you want to head over and check out. Head on over to oakleysi.com to register. Then you can take advantage of our discount code, which is fieldcraft15 at checkout to receive an additional 15% off of your first order. Again, that is oakleysi, Sierra India.com. Built to protect. Make sure you head on over and check that out.
Hey guys, welcome to the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. I'm your host for this episode. My name is Kevin Estella. You've probably heard my voice. You probably see my face on a bunch of the Instagram stuff and maybe on YouTube. Guys, if you are in the training space, please come out and train with us. We got a lot coming up. And you know, we're at that phase in the year where we just have October, November, December ahead of us. So it's real easy for me to kind of give you a rundown of what we have going on. Obviously, you know that our Utah office just opened, the headquarters just opened up there, brand new opening. So shout out to everyone in Provo. If you guys are here in North Carolina or on the East Coast and you've trained with me before, we got the Advanced Survival Experience coming up in just a couple weeks. Land navigation is not only in October, but we have it in November at Winkler Knives. And then we also have it in December back here in Aberdeen. Now, if you are interested in shotgun training, I just found out that I'm going to be teaching a shotgun class in Utah. I think it's like October 28th. It's whatever that Saturday is, the 28th, 29th. I'll be out there and I'm trying to line up a buddy of mine to be my AI, but you'll have a good time blasting shotguns. And I'm probably going to bring out like an old standby pump, whether it's like an 870 or 590. And then I'll bring out one of the new Berettas and you guys can try to outrun that gun. Good luck. You're not going to. Aside from that, we got Aaron Snyder coming here to Aberdeen. That's in November. And then there's a rewilding course out in Utah. That's with Glover. Also a mobility course in November with Mikey Hernandez. And then aside from that, we got another shotgun class here in North Carolina. So we got all sorts of stuff coming up. Please check out the calendar. And for all of you of those, geez, I can't talk today. For all of you who have come out and trained with us so far this year and for helping us sell out all the courses, like selling out at SIG, selling out at Winkler Knives, selling out all over, we really appreciate the hell out of you guys. Thank you so much. So speaking of training and trainers, the podcast guest today is someone who I think you're really going to enjoy hearing her story. She is a trainer. And I want to set the record straight. You know, a lot of people think like, hey, Fieldcraft, they're only going to stick to Fieldcraft groups. You know, Fieldcraft trainers, only Fieldcraft trainers. Listen, guys, I've shot at Glock. I've shot at SIG. I've shot at Gunsight. I'm going to recommend every one of those schools. I've shot with SIOC Tactical Group. I've shot with Kyle DeFore, Bill Rapier. I'm going to recommend all of them. Dave Acosta is a good friend. The way I look at trainers, we are all on the same team. The people who are not on our freaking team are the people that tell you to leave that gun at home or to tell you that you can just wait for the police to arrive. Well, as you find out today in this story, you will not have time for the police to arrive. You really need to be your own first responder, something that we all harp on. And that's a universal message. And one of the reasons why I wanted to bring on this podcast guest, a friend of mine who first met a few years ago when she and her boyfriend showed up to Utah and walked in the headquarters. And I was like, oh my God, I've seen you on Facebook. And we interacted with each other, took some photos, they signed the wall and all that. But her story is really, really remarkable. And I hope you take it to heart. And it doesn't matter if you're male or female, you're going to find out that self-defense is a universal concept. So pay attention to this one. I want to talk about something about my friend, Mary. It sounds like a movie, right? Something about Mary. My good friend, Mary Forgs. So Mary, how are you today?
I am awesome. That's a really great introduction. Thank you.
You know, Mira, I want to say that was okay, but I also got in late last night. I flew back from Chad Robichaud's podcast at God knows what time. I didn't walk into my door until like 12:30, 1 a.m. and I'm exhausted. So that podcast intro probably could have been a little bit better, but it is what it is today. So thanks so much for joining me today.
I can relate to that for sure.
Yeah. So let's give everyone a little bit of a rundown. A few years back, you came into Utah. You were doing a bit of the tour of the national parks, right? I mean, that was how we first interacted, right?
Yes. So Martin and I, we flew into Vegas and we planned a road trip basically up through Zion, Bryce Canyon, Capitol Reef. And we ended the trip with visiting with you up at Fieldcraft. So
yeah. And that trip is unbelievable. Like if people are looking to go out to Fieldcraft, take the Southern route, you know, take the Southern route, visit every one of those national parks. I mean, the national parks are there for your enjoyment. And I think you guys were posting, I think a year or two ago, not too long ago. And you were like, man, that was like the best trip we've ever taken.
It was. And the thing is, on the way back, we actually had the conversation that so many people, they fly out of the country to go find breathtaking views. And I don't think people realize that there's so much right here in the United States that can really set the, you know, those are those core memories that you want, right? So the United States, you know, America itself has a lot of opportunity for sightseeing and memories and those resets that you need from your regular corporate life. And you can visit Utah for a week and then get back into your regular life.
Yeah. And you've got the security of the almighty dollar. It's not like you have to exchange money. It's not like you have to learn a new language. You just get the opportunity to travel domestically. You have security. I mean, it's, and by the way, Utah is kind of like Alaska. It's kind of like Texas where you assume everyone is armed. So in many cases, you're very, very safe because no one wants to mess with anyone. It's not like you go to Chicago or you go to New York City and the rats will carry you away after the gangbangers steal all your shit. So sorry, I'm highly caffeinated to make up for the,
no, I agree.
Yeah. So you and Martin, you guys show up and we start talking and, you know, obviously like Connecticut's got a pretty strong training group. Like I know Bob Margolis is out there and, you know, Ben is out there. You guys should know Ben from Facebook. If you don't know Ben, I won't even go into his last name. He probably doesn't want me to say it, but Connecticut's got like a hardcore training group, Luigi Mondelli and all the guys from Core Firearms and Jiu-Jitsu out there. They've got a legit training group. And you're one of the folks that I consider an outspoken advocate in Connecticut, which is the unconstitutional state for gun rights. But you got into this, or I should say you really started speaking up because of something that happened to you. But before we get to that, or maybe we should start there. How would you like to start this conversation? Because, I mean, you're doing so many incredible things now, but then the story of what you survived is so incredible. What are you comfortable speaking about first?
We can start there. We can start with, I'll dive into that incident in a moment. I'll start with before I became an advocate and instructor. You know, I wasn't really familiar with firearms growing up. You know, my grandfather had a revolver that he carried on him all the time. My first time shooting a firearm was in 2008. My daughter and I, we went to go visit my mom out in Kansas. My mother had some firearms and we shot in the backyard because there's like no neighbors around and you have that property, you know, in Hutchinson, Kansas to be able to shoot. So that was my first actual introduction where I shot a firearm. And fast forward to 2015 is when I actually went and I got my permit. So I'm fairly new to being a gun owner. And I became a gun owner because I became, you know, a single mother at that time. And I realized that I just need to have some type of resource in my home to be able to defend me in case if something does happen. I wasn't necessarily watching the news all the time. You know, I didn't dive into mainstream media or anything like that. It's just obviously that natural instinct that you get as a parent or even as a human being that, hey, I need to be able to defend myself if shit goes down. So I got my permit. My friend Otis, he's a police officer in the town that I live in. He teaches classes with a company called Chamber Ready. He ends up helping me along the lines. And I went and purchased my first firearm at Delta Arsenal in Wallingford, Connecticut here. And that was 2015. So a few years, I had a firearm And I had the, you know, the introduction, the basic fundamentals of being able to shoot, but I didn't have a, actual training. And in 2019, November 15th, it was a Friday night. I was home alone. My daughter was at the movies and my son was at a sleepover. And around 9 o'clock at night, I was actually upstairs on the second floor of my house, and I was texting my new employer. I had been working for Delta Arsenal doing their marketing for 1 week at that point. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, Friday night. I said, you know, thank you for this opportunity with working with you. I'm really looking forward to the future here. And, you know, so I'm texting my boss from Delta Arsenal, and all of a sudden I hear a loud bang, and at the same time my house kind of shakes. So I run downstairs, and again, not having that training in me, which at the time, if I did have training, I probably would have grabbed my gun. But I ran downstairs because I honestly thought that something fell off the wall. I wasn't sure what happened, but it shook my entire house. So I run downstairs into the kitchen, and there is a man that I somewhat knew, standing in my kitchen. And I could tell by looking at him that he was definitely, he had some substances in his body. So I'll give you a little bit of background on this, this guy. So he was friends with my brother from the VA. They were both in a substance abuse program at the VA, and he got shipped around between like Boston to Northampton, Massachusetts, down to West Haven. So different VAs offered different types of programs. And this person had gone down to West Haven, and West Haven shipped him to another facility in Connecticut over by the casino. So he was kind of all over the place. Mm-hmm. And the reason why he knew of me or who I, or where I lived or who I was earlier that year in July for my daughter's birthday party, when my brother came down from the VA, my brother brought 4 or 5 friends with him for my daughter's birthday party at the park. And they came to the house to help bring items from my house to the park for the party, because there's a lot of food and stuff. You know, we're Irish, and we end up, you know, everyone makes food and brings stuff to the party. Right. So he knew of where I lived because he had been at my house twice on that weekend with my brother. And I also was a huge advocate, because I've always been involved with advocacy. So I was a huge advocate for veterans that were struggling with substance abuse and getting rehabilitated back into society from, you know, their lifestyle, I guess, back into society. So that's how I knew this person, is that I had been helping them also with, you know, connections with counseling and stuff like that, resources, basically. I've been assisting with resources with them getting back into society and connecting with family members. I was actually at one time the state coordinator for an organization called 22 Kill, which is based out of Texas, but they assist, they help veterans with exactly what I'm talking about. So that's the backstory on how I knew this guy. So he's standing in my kitchen, and I could tell, you know, he's pale, he's sweaty. Again, it's closer to the end of November. And so he should be freezing, and I'm not sure if he was sweating for sure. And I'm looking into his eyes, and there's just, it's like it's not somebody actually there. It's like a blank stare. He had no pupils at all. I just remember he had blue eyes. So his eyes were like almost the same color as like the whites of his eyes. Like it was very, there's nothing there at all. And it was terrifying. So I tried talking to him. Obviously he had just broken into my house through the back door. I knew that this was not a good situation. I'm analyzing, you know, I have my 2 dogs in the house that are, they're starting to go after each other because they don't like each other. And my gun's upstairs and my phone was upstairs, because again, I didn't think anybody had broken into my house. So I didn't come downstairs prepared. And so he's standing there and he starts rambling something about what his doctor had said earlier that day, and something about a piece of paper that he was looking for. So I said, his name was Mike. I said, Mike, stand here for a minute. I'm going to go upstairs. I'm going to situate the dogs. I'm going to get myself situated, and I'm going to come back downstairs. In my head, I'm thinking I need to get to my gun and I need to get to my phone. I need to call 911. But with my training with mental health crisis situations, I was like, I need to stay calm with him and let him think that I understand what he's going through at this moment.
Can we describe the kitchen? Cause it sounds like it's like the house that my grandmother lived in, where like you've got, it's like a bi-level house, like a raised ranch type. And like the kitchen is like almost like a corridor, like very narrow, like cabinets on both sides. Like, so it's, you're in a tunnel basically.
It is like a tunnel. So the kitchen that I'm standing in, so there's, all right, so the house was actually four floors. You have like the finished basement, finished attic, mm-hmm. but the house was built in like the 1800s. So you do have like an older house. And the floor that I'm on, because the bedrooms are all on the second floor. So there's four bedrooms up there and a bathroom. And then, which the bathroom and one of the bedrooms obviously is going to come into play. And then the first floor you have living room, dining room, and kitchen and foyer. So when I come down the stairs, I'm in the foyer. And I start to move my way to the back of the house where that back door mm-hmm. had been broken into and where he was standing. So it is basically like a tunnel, but I could retreat backwards. So there was the door behind him that he broken into and then the doorway that I came through behind me.
And how much space separated you? How much space separated the two of you at that moment when you first engaged him in conversation?
I'm going to say a good 10 or 12 feet. Like I didn't get close. It's not like where I was like within arm's length or anything. I knew that this wasn't a safe situation. I kind of, as I'm like entering the kitchen, I made a couple steps into the kitchen and realized what was going on. And then I started to back up a little bit, but I didn't rush or anything because I knew that any sudden movements would be potentially dangerous for myself. It would put myself in more danger than I already was. So I backed up and I went back up the stairs and I grabbed my phone off the bed. And as I'm grabbing it, I hear him walking up the stairs and I go over to the top of the stairs. And I have my phone in my hand ready to call 911. At that time, I did not know that you could press I believe it's the power button and the top volume button that will allow for you to call 911 quickly. So instead at the time, I knew that I thought that I could only basically open the app and then dial 911. You know, you have to go through all these different prompts. It's probably about like 6 or 7 steps to actually go through a whole process of dialing 911 and pressing the buttons. So I'm standing at the top of the stairs and he's walking up the stairs towards me. So I'm like, all right, I already told him to stay downstairs. And obviously he's not staying downstairs and now he's moving up here. So I go to back up and he's still coming up the stairs. And so I went to go walk towards him, try to get my peacock feathers going, not aggressively, but like, hey, let's go back downstairs to try to get him to turn around. And he kind of turned and he put his right hand, he kind of like brought it to the side, like telling me to go before him, you know, gesturing for me to walk in front of him. And I said, Mike, I'm going to be honest, this does not feel right now. And I wasn't going to say it, but you just have to give me a minute because this obviously threw me off, you know? And this is all happening so quickly. It might sound like it's, you know, a 5-10 minute conversation, but it's happening. This is all within like about 30 seconds, this, you know, to a minute, this whole entire process. I'm going to say more like 30 seconds. So, I didn't walk down the stairs in front of him because I honestly felt like he was going to push me down the stairs. And, mm-hmm. you know, you get the hair raises up on the back of your neck and you're like, you know, this basically if a dog's about to attack you or, you know, an animal's going to attack you, you get that feeling. You're like, all right, they don't have good intentions. So I went to go back up into my bedroom. And as I'm closing my bedroom door, he lunges at my door. So at the same time with the door hitting hitting the hinges, hitting the door frame, and I'm sliding the lock across, which is just a bolt, which is actually not very stable. So I slide the bolt across on the top of the door and I can just hear his body, you know, he's slamming it up against the door. I'm going to say anywhere between 5 to 10 times. I don't remember, obviously I wasn't counting, but it was between 5 to 10 times is that he's slamming his body against the door. And while he's doing that, I rush back to the other side of my room where my phone was, where my bed is, because in my mind, I'm like, I have to get as far away from this door as possible. Again, not having that training and not realizing that, hey, you have a gun to be able to save yourself in these moments. So looking back on it, it was very, very amateur of me. So I retreat back to my bed, opposite side of the room from the door that he was breaking into. And as he gains entry by smashing into the door. The bolt goes flying from that door frame to the other side of the room. And he, the look on his face, you know, he let out like a really heavy breath, like a pant. And I'm like, he's going to kill me. And at that exact same time, I had been able to, I was able to call 911, but I was able to, because the text that was open with my employer, I opened that quickly. And I, at the top of it, where you could just like hit their name and hit call. So I called him and I was like, I just need somebody on the other end of this phone right now that's going to be able to hear 911. And I know that everybody listening to this right now is like, there's so many amateur moves. Why did she do this? Why did she do this? And everybody's probably really frustrated listening to the story. And I'm frustrated looking back at it too. So I end up pressing call. I call my employer. As the phone's connecting, by that time, Mike is already on top of me. And so we're on top of my bed. My legs are kind of like draped over the side of the bed. My right hand is all the way stretched out, gripping onto my phone because I want it as far away from the situation as possible where I still have some type of control of it, but where he's not going to hear this person picking up on the other line. So my employer knew my address and I was like, if he hears this, he's going to be able to send me help. So my right hand stretched out, my left hand is gripping at his fingers around my throat. At that time, he had both hands around my throat. His knees are on both sides. So, you know, his left knee's on my right side of the torso and his right knee's on my left side. And he's straddling me and just his weight is on my neck. And I'm just doing everything I can to get my left hand to pry his fingers more so just so I can gain air. Mm-hmm. At that moment, I was just like, I just need to breathe, you know, like give me a fighting chance. So I'm gripping his fingers off from my neck and all of a sudden he hears the voicemail. So the employer did not pick up the phone, but he hears the voicemail. So he hears a voice at least talking on the phone saying, you know, obviously he was saying like, leave a message, yada, yada. And that gets his attention to where he looks to the left, again, to my right. And he repositions himself where now his right forearm is onto my neck and he's trying to pry the phone out of my hands with his left hand. So because his body weight also shifted to my right side and I had known that when he went go-karting with my brother over that summer that he had broken his right ribs, a couple of ribs. So I was like, all right, I have some type of advantage right here. You know, his body weight shifted. His focus is not necessarily on killing me right now. It's at getting this phone. And also he already has an injury that I know of. So I just took my, you know, with my left fist, I just started pounding on his ribs on the right. And, he was still very focused on that phone. So I dropped the phone between the bed and the wall, mm-hmm. kind of like if you want a dog, you know, you're trying to get the dog to go in a different direction. And, get them away from you. So I dropped the phone and he was still very focused on that phone that he got off. He let the pressure off of my neck, but he was still straddling me and he was trying to get that phone so he could hang it up. And I was able to continue hitting him and get out from underneath him. And I raced to the other side of my room and I opened the top drawer of my dresser and I pulled out my gun and I turned around. At that time, he was turning around on the bed and shutting off the phone. And he just, at that point, it was kind of cool because he looked helpless, honestly. So, you know, he's holding my phone and he kind of like, his hands kind of like fall to, you know, like into
surrender
the top
position.
Of his lap.
Yeah. Yeah.
And but then he laughs at me, you know, I'm aiming the gun at him and he just kind of laughs and he says, he's like, are you going to shoot me? Are you going to kill me? Along those words, like, are you really going to shoot me? And I was shaking. I was terrified because being a gun owner, yes, you want to be able to defend yourself, but you don't have intentions on ever actually taking another person's life. Mm-hmm. So I was shaking and he asked me again, you know, are you really going to shoot me? I said, if you stand up, I'm going to shoot you. I will pull the trigger if you, you know, whatever wording I used, but it was, if you move, if you even budge, I'm going to kill you. So I like literally just started crying.
Take a moment to compose yourself. I mean, it's so interesting hearing the story because you know, I've known you for so long, and I've known, you know, who you are and how you speak out. And this is the first time I've heard the entire story in such detail. And there are so many times I've heard of other people, you know, family, friends, coworkers and whatnot, who, you know, they say that they had an issue at like at a gas station, or they say that they had an issue at a supermarket with someone who was loud, or maybe it was on the highway. But this is a person who was in your inner circle, a family friend of your brother who you thought you could trust, you know, and then you hear about all these stats, like, you know, if you're going to, you know, be assaulted, it's probably gonna be by someone that you know, or murdered or raped or whatever. Like it's terrifying. And you experience that. So, I mean, I'm sitting here as you're telling the story, and I'm taking notes for like after action and talk about like what you did, what you could have done differently. But I mean, in that heat of the moment, you said it, you were shocked that all this was happening. And, you know, you have that training as the counselor, and you're trying to see the best in humanity, but at the same time, the worst is presenting itself, and it catches you up. Like it shakes you up a little bit.
It does, because again, previously, because of my brother's struggle with alcoholism, that's why I became an advocate to help veterans. And that's also where I became an advocate to, you know, I took the initiative upon myself to get training on being a mental health crisis aide, and to stay on top of that certification, and to get additional training for, you know, like CPR, like basic life-saving skills, being able to Narcan somebody if I'm ever in that situation. That's just something, you know, it wasn't ever job related or anything. Yeah. I was like, these are skills that I feel like as a human being, because of what goes on in society, that I should just at least be knowledgeable on, you know, how to offer these skills. And with the mental health aspect of it, that's where your verbal judo comes in, right? So with me, I'm thinking like, oh, I'm going to be able to communicate with them and talk them down. But when you have somebody that they don't even know where they are or who they are in those moments, you can't talk to somebody, you can't communicate with them if they don't know what reality is in those moments, right?
Right. And I understand like a lot of trainers will say, okay, learn de-escalation, verbal de-escalation. And I agree, verbal de-escalation will keep you out of a lot of fights, a lot of conflict. But there will be some people who you may interact with who are not even aware where they are. They're not even aware what they're doing because they are intoxicated. They're under the influence. You know, prescriptions could be off, who knows what. So I totally see like where your mind was, and it's not unreasonable that you were thinking that way. And gosh, now you go from that de-escalation, you know, trying to talk him down, trying to reason with him, to the point where he's trying to kill you, to now you have the upper hand. And that's where that story left off. So
I'm standing there, and
yeah, go ahead.
You know, he mildly mocks me, and I confirm for him, like, yes, you're not going to make it out of this house. Like, one of us at this point isn't going to make it out. Right. And, you know, thankfully my children weren't home at this time either. So what happens at that time is, again, being, you know, you have like the good citizens of society, you know, the majority of us that are gun owners are really, really good people. And again, you don't have the intention, and you don't want it on your conscience, and you don't want to, you know, you don't want to live with having taken somebody's life regardless. You just want to, for me, it's, I just wanted to live, you know, I didn't want to kill him. I didn't want to take his life or anything. I just want to make sure that I'm alive at the end of the situation. Mm-hmm. And whatever that took, if he moved, yes, I would have shot him. He didn't move. So at that time, again, on a psychological level, I wasn't thinking straight. So I walk out of my bedroom, or not walk out, but I realize that I'm closer to the doorway, because again, at that time, he's on the opposite side of the room from the door. He's over sitting on the side of my bed, and I'm standing again across the room at my dresser. To my left is my doorway from my bedroom. And I was like, I can actually get out of this situation right now. I can leave. I didn't care about getting my phone from him or anything. It was like, there was no thought in my mind that I needed his phone to call 911 because I have neighbors. So I walk out, or I back out of my bedroom door pretty quickly. And in that moment, you know, amateur move again. This is why I'm huge on training now, is because I immediately went to the next closest room where I could barricade myself, which is right across the hall, and it's my bathroom. So it's a smaller bathroom, much smaller. And I get into the bathroom and I lock that door. And as soon as I slide that lock shut, I realize this is the exact same lock that he just broke into, like the same color, you know, make, whatever. It's the same lock that he just broke through the other door. And now I'm in a smaller space. So I just kind of stood there for a second, you know, my gun's ready, and I'm listening to him. You know, again, he had opiates and he had alcohol in his system at the time. So he was not, you know, he wasn't mentally wired at that point. And I could hear him talking to himself in my room. So gauged by where his voice was, I'm like, all right, so he's still on the other side of the room. It doesn't sound close or anything. So I slowly open my door and then I immediately go down that stairway to my left. I run out the front door. And, you know, this is closer to the end of November. I'm barefoot. I'm in shorts and a t-shirt. And I run with my gun in my hand to the neighbor's house. And there's a chain link fence separating my house from the neighbor. So I had to run on the sidewalk along the road. Mm-hmm. And, you know, two cars drove by. And I'm thinking, hopefully somebody's going to call and say there's a crazy lady running with a gun just to get the cops here quickly. You know, like just to get somebody here quick. And I run up from the sidewalk along the chain link fence, run up the neighbor's side on his side of the driveway to his house, to his back door, because he only uses his back door. And I'm banging on the glass, and finally he opens the door, and obviously I'm telling him, call the police. I was just attacked. He could obviously see that I was attacked. And so he ends up calling the police. And as he's calling, I see Mike walking out the back door that he had just broken into. So he's at the back of my property at this point, again, chain link fence dividing us. And I see him just lighting a cigarette. So he's standing in the back by the garage, casually lighting a cigarette. So I end up going back into my house through the front door to get to my phone, to get to my dogs, because again, my dogs hated each other. They were probably going to kill each other. And I go in through my front door. And as I'm walking up, you know, I already have my gun drawn and ready. I'm aiming it through my front door. I could have a clear view from the front door through that foyer, through the kitchen to the back door. So I can see if he's going to be walking into that door. And all the lights were off in the house. So I could see out the dining room that he's still, you know, in the backyard. And I just stood there at the front door in the foyer waiting for the police to arrive with my, you know, my back to the front door and my eyes looking at him through those windows, making sure that he wasn't moving, that he wasn't coming towards the house or anything. Mm-hmm. So cops end up, so you're talking earlier about, you know, being your first responder and how long the response time is for police officers, right? And the cops, between them getting the phone call from the neighbor, then getting dispatched and then arriving, and the police station's about a mile and a half, maybe 2 miles from my home at the time. And it still took them about 10 minutes, maybe a little more than 10 minutes.
Oh my God.
And with that, they drove by my address, which I mean, every time I've gotten DoorDash, Grubhub, anytime I get any type of delivery, that specific address, it doesn't come up right on like a map or on a GPS, and it sets you like a block up the road.
Oh my
so
gosh.
They drove past my address. I see the cruisers fly by with their lights on, and then they come back down the road, and then they end up pulling into the driveway. And as soon as they pulled in the driveway, you know, I could see at that time he was still standing in the backyard. He ends up at one point running and they end up having to get him. But I'm standing at the front and I put my gun down on like the bottom three steps or whatever on the staircase there that led upstairs to the bedroom, because I was like, I don't want to answer the door with, you know, with the police, with a gun in my hand, and the police are standing here seeing me with a gun in my hand. So I put the gun down, I cracked the door open so that way they could see easily right into the house. They could see me standing there and that I didn't have a gun in my hand. And as soon as the officers walked in, I said, just let you know, my gun is right there. So I was very, you know, I did communicate with them. So mm-hmm. they knew that I was not armed at that moment. And so that was the situation. And that night he actually, you know, when he got arrested and he has all these charges against him and everything. And for, I don't know if it was a family member or maybe a bondsman, but he ends up somehow being able to bond out. And there's obviously conditions when you're arrested from attacking a human being, and you're not allowed to go near that person again. So there was conditions of release that said, do not return to this address or contact this person or anything like that. And this was by like 11 or 12 o'clock is like when I knew that he was like in custody, and that I thought I could go to sleep that night. And then I find out like, okay, well, he's now bonded out. So, and they're like, you have nothing to worry about. There's conditions. He's not going to violate those conditions. And I was like, how is that possible? And this guy, knowing that he's on drugs and alcohol, how is he even being released back into society right now? Like, I thought there was some, like a rule where you had to like be able to detox, maybe go to the hospital or something. I didn't think you could get released just because you can make bond. But I end up, you know, falling asleep around like 3:30, 4 o'clock that morning is when I finally fell asleep. And at 5:30, because it was very broken sleep, at 5:30, I wake up to a text from a friend of mine that worked at the police department and who was actually patrolling my district that night. And he said, hey, just let you know, we picked him up again. He was sitting on your front steps. Like, we drove by, he was sitting on your front steps.
God.
So with that, and again, this guy, he's originally from Boston. And at that time, he was in the program in West Haven. So his family's all up in Boston. And I don't know if he had been in the program in Boston, would he have gone after his own family members or something? I really don't know why he decided to target me. And other than that, I was like maybe a familiar face that was in the area of the West Haven VA, you know? So arrested him again. So I believe they actually, there was like a patch article that says, you know, man arrested twice in Naugatuck within 8 hours or something like that. Like they actually put out like a brief patch article about it. Wasn't like super in detail or anything, but so yeah, so that is my story. So I think you could understand with all those hiccups that I made and those, not just hiccups, but like crucial errors, why I immediately, you know, not immediately, I took about like 5 or 6 months to, you know, go see a therapist and talk about what had happened. And eventually I was like, you know, I don't like using the word victim. I prefer the word survivor. Right.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm going to do what I can to help other people, help other women specifically that, you know, they might be a gun owner and they don't understand that training is really crucial. Like, yes, you have a tool, but do you know how to use it? So that's, man. That is why I became an advocate and an instructor.
Hey y'all, Amber L here. And today I want to talk to you about teeth. So I know this seems like an off topic here, but it's actually not. When you are focused on health and wellness as a priority in your self-reliant lifestyle, like I do in my home, your teeth really do get a spotlight. And so ever since my kids were little, I wanted an option for fluoride, a safer alternative than fluoride, because I knew that fluoride was not the best solution for what I wanted in my kids in their prophylactic lifestyle, which means preventative lifestyle. And so I settled on a substance called nanohydroxyapatite, and I've used it for years. It's actually a biomimetic substance, which means it has the same material in it that's found in your teeth and your bones, and now has been touted by the American Dental Association as a safe alternative to fluoride. It even has medical applications outside of dentistry, and it's been proven to be as effective as fluoride at remineralizing your teeth. So we found this brand called No BS, literally only the good stuff, No BS, and we are giving you 15% off your first 1 month supply of No BS. It's a small 1 month jar that you use to brush your teeth. So I know it's not paste in a tube, it's a jar that has the nanohydroxyapatite that you use on a brush to clean your teeth. You can find out more by visiting www.betterbiome.com and using the code FIELDCRAFT. That's FIELDCRAFT. If you're interested in learning more about how to have a prophylactic lifestyle with your oral health and you want an alternative to fluoride, definitely go check them out.
Mayor, I have a million questions for you, and I'm sure the listeners who are listening now probably are like, please ask this question, please ask that question. So I want to just kind of go back through a few different things and just ask you some questions and get some answers. So obviously you try the de-escalation, and for someone who is under the influence, you know, it's probably not going to work. They're not clear-minded. They're not thinking. The 911 call, I think that is so incredibly important, understanding that you do have that emergency function. And I'm sure listeners have had the same experience where you're diddling with your phone in your pocket. Next thing you know, it says emergency call, like authorized or whatever. So where can people go? Do you know where they can go to find out that information on how to do an emergency call without going through like lock screen, putting in your code, all that stuff?
I mean, I would start by saying right here on this podcast.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah.
But other than that, I mean, I'm not sure how it works on Android phones. That I have an iPhone, mm-hmm. so I'm not sure how it works on Android phones. But I would say, you know, anybody that's listening to this, as you're listening, you should be Googling also, like, how do I do that? I think that that's something that we just have to take the initiative to learn on our own. I think that it would be beneficial for police departments to put that information out on their social media, but I don't have control over them. You know, all I have is control over myself. So,
yeah.
And same with the listeners, is like, all we can do is seek education and information on our own, really. You know, we can't expect other people. So that's what I would say is look on, you know, Google it and find out, like, how does my phone call 911? Because that's the most important thing that your phone can do out of all the social media and like dating apps or whatever else you're using for your phone. Like the number one thing is that you should be able to call for an emergency. That's the purpose of a phone.
Wow. Okay. So now you go into your room and you attempt to lock the door and he's pushing into the door, trying to break into the door, and you move to the far side of the room. Is that because of like the knowledge of duty to retreat? I know Connecticut doesn't have, you know, the same freedom, so to speak, to defend yourself in your home. And you really do need to go to like that point of like last retreat, I think they call it. But I mean, was that because you were like, I'm just going to put space between me and, you know, and Mike, or?
I do. I think it's that it was just that natural instinct, you know, like a survival instinct is, mm-hmm. Cause I can't honestly say, I can't speak for everybody, but I can't say like when you are actually having your life threatened, I don't know if people are actually thinking about like, all right, well, what are the laws here? You know, what am I supposed to do like legally? Or what was I told? Other than if you have like additional, you know, extensive training, but in that situation, it was just survival mode. I'm like, all right, so he's there. Where's the furthest I can get from him? And that's where I was, you know, he comes in one side of the room and I'm diagonal. At that point, I diagonally went over to my room or went over to my bed and made as much distance as possible. And yeah, so that's what it was. It's just strict survival mode.
Yeah. And I like how you say, you know, you don't like talking about like the mistakes. Like, I think it should be more of a lesson learned, because with a mistake, it seems like it's more of like a punishment, but whenever you have a lesson, there's always an opportunity for learning. When you heard that loud noise and you walked downstairs, in retrospect, would you have alerted the loud noise, like saying, hey, what is that? Like, would you have wanted to alert that you have a firearm? Would you wanted to access that tool, go downstairs and address it, you know, with like, say like an element of surprise? Like, have you replayed it and said, if I did this, the outcome would have been differently?
Absolutely. I replay it for myself, you know, in my own head, at least like a couple times a month, not where I'm like obsessive over it, but I'm just like, all right, like, how could I have been better, right? Mm-hmm. Or the best version of me, not just better, but like the best. And I also replay, you know, when I'm training down at Loft and I'm telling my story down there, and I'll replay it then too. Like, all right, so like, what is the right way to do this? And yeah, I should have had my gun on me. I should have communicated. I should have already been calling 911. And I'll tell you, like, honestly, what I thought it was is because I had a very large mug rack that was hanging in my kitchen above the table, like a dinette type table. Mm-hmm. And like probably like 5 months earlier or something like that, the mug rack had fallen off the wall because I suck at hanging things up. The mug rack fell off the wall and it had broken like half my dishes and stuff. So I honestly thought that's what it was. So when I went downstairs, I'm like, oh my God, like I did not secure it enough. And I thought that the mug rack was going to be on the ground and all my mugs were going to be broken. And that wasn't it, obviously, at all. But that in my head, I'm like, all right, it fell again. And, you know, when I was first a gun owner, you know, before diving into the training aspect of it, and I was still an amateur, is where I didn't want to be seen as like paranoid. And like, if I'm walking downstairs and if I'm like communicating, like, hey, just let you know, I have a gun, who's there, you know, right, I'm trying to communicate with people. I'm like, I don't want to look like a paranoid person or anything. And now looking at it, I'm like, yeah, no, I'm definitely going to say who's there. I'm going to be a lot more cautious. I'm going to go down the stairs or up the stairs quietly so I can hear what else is going on. If there's somebody moving in my house, you know, I'm going to start listening to things and not let myself be seen so quickly. You know, I probably wouldn't have you know, looking back on it, I shouldn't have gone downstairs so quickly and rushed down there. I should have paused for a moment, listened, maybe look out the window, see if there's something going outside. You know, I should have looked at other, used other resources to analyze what was, what that situation was.
Yeah. It's almost, then, it's almost like a selling point for having security cameras in your house, like Ring cameras, where you can, you know, access it on your phone and see, okay, who is in my kitchen before I go down, you know?
Absolutely.
So, I mean, I think that is definitely justification to have that. So you can travel with your eyes before you travel with your feet.
Absolutely. I think it's very important. And I have Ring cameras now. So, and every lock in my house has two or three locks on it, or every door in my house has two or three locks on it. So I've learned a little bit more of security, obviously, since that incident.
You know, I it's crazy because there are people out there that will criticize a young woman, right? Imagine like the young woman has never experienced any type of violence and they'll criticize her for carrying a pistol on her. But if you have been a survivor of violence, people will say, oh, well, we understand why she does that. You know, she's been through a lot. So there's such a double standard in the world with, if you have been the victim or the survivor, then it's okay. Right. But if you're just taking advantage of your freedom, God-given freedom to carry a tool on you that can protect you or multiple tools to protect you, then you're paranoid. You know, like it drives me crazy. And yet you explain that to people and they'll say, well, you're just saying that because, you know, you're really for the Second Amendment. You're really for, you know, people carrying guns. I'm like, no, I'm for safety. And as you said, you weren't going to try to kill him. You were trying to preserve your life. And that is such an important way of describing why you carry what you carry. It's not because you fantasize about killing people. You fantasize about taking a trip with your daughter and your son someday, you know, like you want to keep your life going. You know, you had your pistol in the top drawer. And I know a lot of people are like, well, when I get home, I take my pistol and I put it in a safe because I have kids around. You know, what's even safer than a safe is keeping it on your person until the kids can't see you take it off at the end of the night. You know what I mean? Like, I am not a fan of any type of, you know, safe for, say, like the gun that you're using for your carry pistol. Like, I get it. If you have hunting rifle, shotguns, if you have, you know, the fun race gun or multiple firearms, you know, family heirlooms, put those in a safe. But there should always be that pistol that you carry within immediate access. And by that, I mean, no more than two beats away. Like it's in the bag that you're wearing around your waist. It's in the holster that's underneath your shirt. And you should have to just clear that garment, get that master grip, present the gun. You know, there are people out there that will say, well, I'll just go and grab my safe. Well, are you sure you have the time? Like when you told me that it was, when you told me it was 10 minutes, I was like, holy crap, an hour, a mile and a half away, 10 minutes to respond to that. Like, you can run a mile and a half in 10 minutes.
Right. You could. And again, that could have been, you know, because I go to the neighbor's house and his information that he gets from me and what he obviously visually saw is like, all right, my neighbor got attacked. But I'm thinking, you know, looking back on it, like he knows his address. Does he know my numeric, you know, because sometimes it'll jump like eight numbers or something. So he could give his address, obviously, and he could say, yes, the house next door to me. But at that time, are they going to the house on the other side of it? Did he give the right information too? And that's another thing. Like, you know, I'm an emergency dispatcher. And one of the things that I touch base on when I'm training down in Florida is, or instructing down in Florida is that, yes, you know, self-defense, but also like you need to know how to call 911. You need to know what information is important because if maybe you're not the one getting attacked and maybe it's maybe you're a bystander and you're seeing something, you know? So in this situation, my neighbor called 911. I didn't stick around for that phone call or anything. I automatically started going back over to my house because he was confused at that moment too. Like he was kind of in shock, you know, he's standing there and he's like, oh my God, like, are you okay? Like he was shocked. And so that could have delayed him and he could have, you know, I'm looking back at it. He could have walked inside. I know his brother was living around that time. He could have been like, the neighbor was just attacked. I had to call 911. There could have been a delay on his side, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and also him possibly stumbling on the information and him saying like, well, I just know it's Mary and she lives next door to me, but I don't know, you know, I don't know if the other person's armed or anything. So there's, as a dispatcher, like we have to ask questions to the caller. And if the caller doesn't have the information, that could delay the phone call also. And then also, you know, if those police officers are already on a call, you know, the town I live in, we only have four or five officers that are on at a time. So let's say if there's already a similar call, you know, some type of assault or a domestic or a robbery, something like that, where somebody's life is also in danger in that moment on a Friday night, you know, 10 o'clock at night, then are those officers leaving that call and rushing to my call? So there's different factors that come in. It's not, I wouldn't ever say, like, you know, that it's negligence on the police department, because I'm obviously a huge supporter of law enforcement and believe you are too.
Yeah.
And it's just, there's all these other factors that come in. But with that, you can't allow for those factors to jeopardize your life. That's why, again, you have to be able to defend yourself. You have to be able to, you know, preserve your existence is really what it is.
When you said you ran across the street to the neighbor's house, you said that he could clearly see that you were attacked. I mean, was the extent of that like bruising? I mean, did Mike strike you? Was it all choking?
He hit me. Yeah, he hit me in the face. It had to be in the process of, I believe, like right before he started choking me. It went pretty quickly. I think it was like right before he started choking me or somewhere in that process. I did get hit in the face a couple times. I was, you know, his hands are around my neck, so you could see the redness and whatever else around my neck. I didn't know what I looked like in that moment. So whatever he saw, because that neighbor checked up on me, like, you know, every single day via text, like we exchanged numbers, and it is an older gentleman. He's like 60 years old. And he was like super concerned about me from that point moving forward. And, but whatever he saw in those moments, he also was like, this is, you know, this is terrifying to see, you know, this woman standing here in this condition. So, but yeah, I did. I had, abrasions on my face. I had the marks, you know, around my neck. He ended up breaking my necklace, obviously, off my neck also in that process. But
I think it's important for the listeners to understand too, like the danger that is associated with getting choked. You know, I know from like grappling and jiu-jitsu, you know, there's different types of chokes that are out there. And if you're listening and you've never experienced one, there are air chokes where you might think, well, I'm just going to hold my breath. And maybe you can hold your breath, but you have to understand that the more dangerous type of choke that you can experience is a blood choke. And I don't care how long you can hold your breath for, with a proper blood choke, you're out in about 8 seconds. So think about how long 8 seconds is. Think about how long 10 minutes that police response time is, and just understand like the gravity of everything that Mary just went through. I mean, it's frightening, because when you're out, you don't know what that person's doing to you or what they have done to you until you wake up. And it's exactly. Terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying.
Or if you wake up, really.
Exactly.
And that's the thing, you know, like when I was like gasping for air and I'm pulling his fingers off of my throat, that at that point, obviously my concern is like, all right, I need to get air. And once he kind of shifted his body weight, I don't know why it came to, I mean, I'm a mom, so that has to be why, but I immediately was like, my daughter's at the movies. What is she going to see when she comes home? She's going to see her mom beaten and lifeless. And this guy could still be in the home. Like if I'm gone at that moment, or even just unconscious, if I'm unable to defend myself, I can't defend my daughter. And when she comes home from the movies, is she going to be that next victim? What is he going to do to her? And that puts like a whole different level of fight in you. Like it's one thing to fight for your life, but to fight for like a loved one's life, I feel like I had a lot more in me to fight for her. If that makes sense.
Yeah. You're the mama bear.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah. So one thing you said that your son was at a sleepover and your daughter was at the movies. So she comes home. Is it in the middle of speaking to the cops? Is it after all this? Do you call her immediately and say, go with your friends? Like, what was the protocol for your kids after that?
So he broke into the house probably about like within a half hour of her leaving the house. So I don't know if he was sitting outside or something, but it was like about half hour after she got picked up by her friend's parent and they went to the movies. And the movies are about like 2 or 3 hours, I'm going to say. So when she finally got home, it was closer to midnight or around midnight. And the police were still there actually. And I text the father and I said, hey, if you could just take your time, there's police at my house right now. And I don't want Lily coming home to see them here also. Like, I'd rather explain to her on my own. Like, for her to be pulling up to the home and family, I mean, her friends pulling up and everybody seeing, like, oh my God, there's cops at the house. What happened? That's like a whole level of fear that I didn't want her to feel as she's pulling up. So
yeah.
I text the father. And then when they got to the house, you know, obviously I talked to her about what had happened and everything. And then, like, I get about like an hour later, you know, this is closer to like probably midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm going to say about 1 o'clock in the morning at this time is when, you know, there's an officer that pulls up into the driveway and they're telling me, you know, he ended up bonding out and we just only let you know, but you have nothing to worry about. And they actually said like where he got dropped off because the police department has to go drop him off somewhere. So they're like, oh, we dropped him off on North Main Street. I don't know if you know Naugatuck at all, but like Cumberland Farms, North Main Street. And I'm like, that's less than 2 miles from my house. Like, that's right by the police department. Like, I'm like, you dropped him off pretty close to my house. You couldn't drop him off on the other side of town at a different town line, but they have to drop him off at like a town line and they can't go outside of the town. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of it is supposed to be his responsibility to get back home to Boston or wherever. And that's obviously why he walks that like 2 miles or whatever back to my house, is because he didn't have money. You know, he's in a not good place and there wasn't anybody to help him. So for whatever reason, he ended up back on to my porch. So, but yeah, so the kids, you know, again, Lily, she was not home at the time, but she did see the police officers come back. So then she ends up saying like, Mom, there's cops in the driveway again. And I had to go downstairs and talk to them again, but in front of her. So, yeah, it was, I'm not gonna say, I don't know. It could have been traumatizing. I'm sure she sees it as a level of trauma from her perspective. Mm-hmm. And she's gonna probably have to talk to somebody about it one day. But all I know is like, at least I made sure that she wasn't a physical victim, you know, that she didn't have to endure any type of physical pain or anything like that. And that's all I could really do with that situation.
You know, something I'm curious about is, did they ever discover the motive? Like, what motivated Mike to come after you? Did he ever confess that?
So this happened again, end of 2019, and there was a court case for, like, we had to go to court. Not we had to go to court. He had to go to court because he had charges against him. So, the next court date that was scheduled for him was like, it was sometime in March, and then, you know, Friday 13th in March is when Connecticut shut down everything because of COVID, and that's, you know, 2020. So then all of a sudden the court date starts getting pushed back, like everything had to be put on hold. So he ended up dying eventually in April of 2021, but there was no, I never got like any understanding, no apology, anything. And that sucks, but there is comfort. I hate saying it. There is comfort knowing that he's not out there anymore. You know, he died in a hotel room from substance abuse up in Boston area, April of 2021. And I mean, I don't need the apology obviously now, because I just know that he can't ever do it again. You know, that's the thing. If I don't know what triggered it in the first place, if I don't know why he came at me in the first place, then I don't know if he would come after me again.
And what were the charges that he was going to be facing if they ever did get to a court date? Was it attempted murder?
There was assault, strangulation. There was interfering. There was not kidnapping, but something along the lines of kidnap. I don't remember what the word was. But there's a list of charges. Originally, he was brought in as like disorderly and like two other charges. So I think that's why he was able to bond out like so lowly. And then they were like, all right, well, we're going to change those charges because this is obviously a lot more than that. But originally the arresting officer charged him as like some basic, not basic, but like smaller, much, much more minor charges. And then those obviously can get changed by the court or once you're going through the court process.
Do you feel like the criminal justice system failed in that respect?
Absolutely. And I'll say just another example I'll share with you, quick story, is just in the past 2 weeks, I've helped a woman that she was assaulted in Portland, Maine, and she resides in Connecticut, and the assault continued into New Hampshire, and two police departments failed her, and they, you know, that she was in a vehicle after she had been assaulted, and they didn't look in the vehicle. You know, they were called basically, I think, like to a domestic. So six officers end up responding to the call, and she's a friend of mine, and they respond to the call, and the person that assaulted her had her inside the vehicle hiding, and basically said, like, if the cops know you're in here, you're not going to see your kids again. And they didn't even look in the vehicle. You know, officers just talked to him. And even though they're getting called to a complaint of somebody screaming for help, and they show up and they don't even look at this vehicle. So I do feel like, I can't say it's like necessarily the officers themselves, because I like to think that, you know, for the majority, police officers are good people, you know?
Right.
But I will say that I think some people can be lazy. And additionally, I don't think there's enough training when it comes to domestics. I don't know what they go through with training, so I can't necessarily judge it firsthand. But all I know is that end result, what's happening with any type of an assault, or even with criminals in general, you know, like criminal system right now with these kids stealing vehicles or assaults and robberies that are going on across the nation. I just feel like they're not very strict laws by any means.
Gosh, what a story. And I mean, it obviously empowered you into becoming a trainer, into speaking out. I'm assuming that you've had feedback from other survivors of domestic violence who have shared stories and whatnot. Like, there has to be a rewarding sense to know that your experience might encourage women to get a restraining order, right? Or men to get a restraining order, which I know, right. Gavin DeBecker back in the day, you know, in the book Gift of Fear, he says, you know, always see if a person's willing to get a restraining order, because that at least demonstrates that they're willing to take a step to protect themselves. But the criminal is not going to respect a piece of paper if they're planning on doing something that has graver outcomes than what a restraining order is going to do. Just violate a restraining order, you get a slap on the wrist. Well, what right. if they don't care about that slap on the wrist because they want to kill you? You know, it's, oh my God. Go ahead.
Criminals in general don't follow laws, and somebody that is, again, not psychologically wired correctly, or they're under the influence of any type of substance, if they have intent to hurt another human being, they're not thinking about, like, oh, what are the repercussions? Like, maybe I shouldn't do this. Morally, you shouldn't do it. There shouldn't even have to be a law that says you can't hurt another human being. But they're, you know, they think that the piece of paper is going to protect them. And you know, we had an incident about a year ago in Milford, Connecticut, and the woman had a restraining order. She went to the police. She, you know, voiced her concerns, very strong concerns. You know, he was threatening to kill her, and they, you know, they stopped him with a restraining order. And sure enough, he goes down. He lives in Danbury, drives down to Milford, and he took an axe to her and he killed her with her kids in the house. So pieces of paper doesn't mean anything. And the first thing, you know, every single time we hear these incidences of these victims, not just from domestic, but like any type of assault and homicide or anything like that, the first thing we think is they should have been able to defend themselves, you know. And that doesn't mean to, you know, you don't have to learn jiu-jitsu or anything like that. You should be able to use whatever tool you are confident with that is going to save your life. You should be able to use that tool to defend yourself. So that's why, again, yes, it's pretty important, I think, for women to be able to at least learn what a firearm can do to save their life. I don't think everyone should have one, but I do think that it's important for them to understand what the capability is, and that your life expectancy goes up drastically if you have that tool.
Yeah. And I think the training, as you mentioned, it needs to be broad, because there will be opportunities where you cannot use a firearm to defend yourself because it's not necessarily an attack against, say, like your life or your like bodily harm, you know. But like, you should be able to learn how to put distance between you and your attacker. Like, you should learn how to run. You should learn how to run really far and fast. You should learn how to create frames with your body, you know, elbows and knees and whatnot. You should learn how to strike. You should learn how to grapple. You realize, like, okay, if you have just that firearm, there's that old expression, if you only have a hammer, all you see is nails. But I think when women and men and young kids, because I think this also applies to young kids, I think when you realize how empowering it is to truly know that you could take care of yourself, you don't want to stop learning. It creates a fire inside where it's like, I can defend myself, but more importantly, not only can I defend myself, I'm going to defend the people around me. Like you said, your daughter, your son, and surround yourself with people who are capable of defending you. You know, it's like, there will be people in your family, there will be people in your tribe who can't defend themselves, maybe by age, maybe by disability or whatever. That's your job now to defend them, you know, but if you can surround yourself with individuals that make that conscious effort to learn how to be capable. My God, what a story. I mean, if someone wants to reach out to you now, or if someone has something that they want to share, or if they're looking for advice, I mean, how are they able to get in touch with you?
To get in touch with me is probably best through Instagram. I mean, you know, I post on there regularly, but I communicate with people on there regularly too. And so that Instagram is everything about dot Mary. So it's kind of like something about Mary that you referenced at the beginning, but it's everything about period Mary. And yeah, that would probably be the best way. I mean, I have other forms of communication other than smoke signals and pigeons, but I think that Instagram is probably the best route.
Yeah. For now, until, you know, the powers that be over at Instagram tell you that you can't share your message because you're empowering people and they want,
right.
You know, trust me, we've seen a whole bunch of that lately, which is why I'm switching over to Twitter as much as possible. And it's basically the same account that I have at Instagram. It's the same account at Twitter, but I think more people need to hear your story. And I'm encouraging anyone that listened to this, if you had a moment where your jaw dropped, please share this with someone. Share it with someone that you care about, someone who maybe is reluctant to start training or reluctant to read a book about, you know, situational awareness, because this is just so powerful. And as I mentioned, like, don't stop with learning how to pull a pistol, learn scenario-based training, learn how to, you know, create space by picking up some grappling. You don't have to get a super high rank in any grappling art. Just get the experience, learn what that pressure feels like, and just don't be afraid to voice your concerns. Don't be afraid to speak up. I mean, empower yourself. If there's one final message that you want to leave the listener with, Mary, is there anything that you want to like really hit home and hopefully they'll follow you?
I would say my biggest takeaway out of my journey, at least in the past couple of years since my incident, is that as parents, you know, we have that responsibility to protect our kids when they're growing up. And the thing is that, you know, I've learned that I have to teach them how to protect themselves. So instead of me just being their protector and saying, you know, I'm their first responder, if you're a parent, then get your children into some form of self-defense. It doesn't have to be anything drastic. It could be, again, just maybe verbal judo or teaching them how to use a flashlight to interrupt somebody's OODA loop, something along those lines. But start teaching your kids skills, because we have to protect them for life. You don't protect them just as you're growing, as you're raising them. You have to make sure that they have those skills and that confidence to protect themselves when they're no longer in your home. And when they have their own families, these are skills that, you know, I learned when I was 35 or about 35 years old. And it's something that I feel like teenagers should be learning. Kids should be learning, you know, this should be something that my parents should have taught me, or school systems or something. So my message would be, you know, if you're a parent, then it is your obligation to teach your kids how to defend themselves and how to survive and how to communicate.
Wow. Well, Mary, I can't thank you enough for coming on and sharing your story. So I really appreciate your time and all the emotion that you put into that. And there's no doubt your message will save lives.
Thank you. I appreciate you allowing me this opportunity, for sure.
Of course, anytime. And guys, thank you so much for listening to the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. I've been your host, Kevin Estella. Until next time.